Bandwidth for the Weird Things podcast provided by WiredTree. For sites of any size and world-class customer service, head on over to WiredTree.com.
Welcome to After Things. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Brian Brushwood.
Hello, beautiful people.
Justin Robert Young.
Hello, friends.
And our producer, Mr. Bryce Castillo.
Hi, everybody.
Gentlemen, yeah. So, you know, one of the things we deal with as creatives, and we're all creatives here, you know, we're all creative people. I think most of our listeners are people who are creative, and being a creative doesn't necessarily imply that we're any good at it, but it does mean that we spend a lot of our time making things or taking ideas and making them into stuff. And the problem as a creative is that, well, you create and you come up with ideas all the time. And I know I'm sitting here with 3D prints next to me. I've got windows with code sitting below me. I've got a thing for novels in front of me and emails for I can say that I have a TV project that is in the works.
Congratulations.
But, yeah, we'll get more details as I'm allowed to give details on that, but I can say that.
Is it fair to say a pretty big deal? Like pretty
big. Yeah, it's not a novel. This isn't a novel. This isn't one of my books. That's other stuff. That maybe some other.
No. I'm sorry. What I mean is it's not a chump change third tier.
Yeah, it's trash.
It's rad. It's rad, and we look forward to talking about it. Because I don't want to get into coyly being coy.
Correct. Okay, I agree.
Yeah. So, I haven't said anything because I don't like to play the game of like I'm doing something, but you know,
yeah.
Particularly because I have books, and people are like, is it a book? I'm like, oh no, is it my favorite book? Is it my favorite book going to be like, no, it's not. It's not that. I'm like, good luck to you, Andrew. It's like, So trying to manage this stuff is as we all can understand, it's overwhelming. It is extremely overwhelming, and you know, I have. In a couple of weeks, I have the second Theo Cray book is due out, or is getting, you know,
how soon?
March 14th.
Oh my gosh, it's right around the corner. That's amazing.
Mm-hmm. In the midst of that, I've got to write another book. And so I have to, you know, a lot of trying to manage stuff and all that, which gets to be stressful. And in the middle of that, putting together IKEA furniture so I can organize this place. And I have wrestled with most of my life of like, what should I be doing? What should I? And we all go through this, you know, we all go through this sort of like, what should I do? And Brian, you were working for, you know, Dell, and you're like, I don't know if this is for me. Justin was, you know, twice we plucked from, you know, doing filing permits in New York City to go, I don't think this is for me. And then plucked from Coconut Creek, Florida, in a warehouse, putting together magic tricks, going, I don't think this is for me, you know, and then thrice, then, you know, doing the Go game, going, I don't think this is for me.
Well, and to be honest, this is something that I said at, I'm so glad to hear you bring this up because I stumbled across this thought. The honors program that I did at UT is called Plan 2, and one of the benefits of it is that you spend the first 2 years, it's interdisciplinary. So they tell you to take, you know, get all the basics. Here, take your math, write a billion papers, you know, and figure out what you like and don't like. And then you get a focus and you take whatever classes are related to it. And so they asked me to talk on a panel to a bunch of sophomores in the program, of which I am an alumnus. And I said, do literally anything to figure out what you hate. It's easier to know what you love by drawing the outlines of it as the things you hate. And it's a crass way to put it, but I think it's very effective. Figure out what you hate and do the opposite, and that very likely will be something that you love. And so later on, somebody sent me an email saying, hey, do you have any ideas of what I should do on the YouTube channel? And I wrote the same thing. I was like, do literally anything to figure out if you love it or hate it. The worst thing you could do is sit around waiting for a good idea, waiting to figure out, doing like there's so much value artistically, motivationally, intellectually that comes from doing stuff that makes you mad to even remember having done it. The more I hated an experience, the more valuable that experience tended to be in guiding me to things that I later went on to love. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. Justin?
Yeah, and I would say what you find is sometimes counterintuitive because, you know, they're... You know, Andrew mentioned that what I was doing before I came down to back home to South Florida was like sitting and waiting in line professionally to file building permits. Now, you might think, hey, that's a lot of time that you have to yourself. If you're literally just sitting in the Department of Buildings between Manhattan, Brooklyn, and Queens, then... That's a lot of free time you can do what you want with. There's a lot of being out of the office. There's not a lot of sitting in front of a computer, but it was miserable. I hated it, right? And it's like, okay, well then what don't I like about this? If I'm out of the office, if I'm doing more stuff, it's like, okay, well, I don't like that my time's not mine. I don't like that I get to be pushed around and stupid things like they shut off the internet one day. Or like they blocked a bunch of internet sites and including like Facebook and stuff like all the fun stuff that you'd want to do on the internet. And I asked them, I'm like, well, why? They're like, oh, well, because a lot of people are just like shopping online during the day. And I'm like, but what about me? Like, oh, you're doing great. You're doing amazing. Yeah. I'm like, well, then why don't you turn my internet back on? And they're like, well, because we can't. We don't like, it's just a thing where we don't want one person to have it. And I'm like, okay. And that is petty and small that it was like part of the reason why I'm like, okay, well, not to say, I mean, I think I would have went down and worked with Andrew no matter what, because the opportunity was there and it would have made me happier. But it is something that like when I then went back to the Go Game and I was taking a more traditional paycheck, I would not have considered a job that put limits on my freedom and creativity that didn't value my own time as explicitly mine, that I do exactly what I want to do and you give me parameters under which I can deliver, and that is our agreement throughout this. Like, that's something that like really kind of shaped the fact that I'm a bad employee who likes to, you know, do whatever he wants as long as I'm delivering, right?
But again, that it's that phrase, as long as I'm delivering. And that's one thing. And Bryce, maybe you could chime in on this. I think I've been pretty good as we've grown in making it explicit to everybody as they join the team that it's like we're paying for results. I think I've been... Like, can you think of any time I've asked you about how you manage your time and tried to make suggestions on how what you could do could be more effective or any of that stuff or more in line with?
Not that you're on the spot with.
Yeah, sorry. No, yeah, and this is an unfair way to put it.
And this is not a leading question to have you talk about how good of a boss Brian is.
Yeah,
I
know.
What I'll say is, yes, we are very results focused because so much of what we work on is deadlines. But I think also a lot of it is kind of being left to your own devices to figure stuff out.
Yeah.
Without very little of what anybody who's worked here has gotten is training or apprenticeship or anything, which is for most people a very bad thing.
Really interesting. That's a weird...
People need to be onboarded and understand the environment and dynamics. And because we're also very remote... there's very little opportunity for like, hey, real quick, can you, because everything becomes a thing when everyone is remote. It's like, oh, hey, we need to like, I need to get in touch with you and send you stuff or X, Y, or Z. And so I think there is a lot of flexibility in the things that we do. But I think a side effect of that is we're all very isolated. And if you were a new person, it would be tough coming in.
I'll be really curious to see what the effects are because you're right. That's an inherent bias in the way we've run things so far. It'll be really interesting to see what the long-term effects of that are, positive and negative.
Mm. Yeah. Because, I mean, it's really nice for a lot of the schedule stuff that I do. You know, we do Monday, which is like a 10-hour day for me, and then Night Attack goes past midnight most Tuesdays. And then, it's a very open schedule. You get all the good and bad that comes with that, of just like, well, we've got X, Y, and Z coming up, but then here's a bunch of time that you don't have to be accounted for. So it kind of goes both ways.
Yeah.
It's different temperaments. Like, yeah, I worked a desk job for a very short period of time, and the weirdest one in the world, but, you know, the James Rand Educational Foundation. So, you know, where you're
is that the sum total of your behind the desk work experience? Oh, yes. How weird. That's wonderful.
Yeah. Like, I'm looking at photos of ghosts all day,
to crackpots and crazy people.
Yeah, and it was
by the way, that's Andrew's like, well, humping a desk 9 to 5. Like, I'm just like you, normal folks.
And
working for the weekend.
Anybody who knows me knows I work nonstop. I work nonstop. I am always working on projects, doing stuff. It is hard for me even to stop and watch. Like, the only time I'll generally watch a Netflix show is, and, you know, I'll go to bed and watch something for an hour or so before I go to sleep. Mm-hmm. I love to work. I love to do things. And maybe that's not the healthiest thing in the world, but I don't like office hours. To me, it's you know, office hours are not the thing for me. But amount of time that I put into work, I couldn't even, if you asked me to add up how many hours did I spend working on a book or working on a code project or working on the TV thing I'm working on or whatever, it would be easier for me to subtract the time that I wasn't. Mm-hmm. And I like that. And the thing that I've had to now, I have a lot more peace of mind now, because the way I've been managing multiple projects now is I've gotten really into sort of time focused and saying the idea that, like, I have a software project that I've been working on that relates to sort of the TV thing kind of thing, an ancillary sort of thing. And I wanted to get enough work done because I have a really fast deadline, like what's coming up. But I've got to go, you know, like I've got to go shoot something in like 8 weeks, less than that. But meanwhile, I've got to write another book, you know, and I had to write another book last month and get that done. And now I've got to turn around another book. But I said, okay, I want a little time between the last book and this book. So I will spend 2 weeks jumping into the software project, figure out figure out how far I can take it, then set that as my deadline. And then my drop dead was last night, and I was actually up till 3 a.m. solving one last little problem that I needed to figure out how something was going to work. And then now it's like, that goes to the side now. And now I'm like, this week, I'm just outlining. This week, my job is to outline this book, and then my job next week is to write the book. And then after that, I can jump back into it. And I have another bigger, grander project I want to do, but I'm like, nope, that's until I'm done shooting, you know? And so that's how I've been working on my sort of, cause I have bigger tasks and smaller stuff. And like, I'm like, oh, the next big thing I'm trying to work on, I need to put that till after. So I would just say that, like, I've been having the most success lately, and this has been over the last year, is I don't stress out about deadlines or anything like that anymore. Cause I just sort of say, this is the time that I have to do it. Give myself double the time to do it. And then once I have to start on this day with that, drop whatever I was doing previously and go into the next thing.
So you're doing more serial time slicing than trying to work in parallel. Like,
yeah, I think parallel for the most part is BS.
Yeah,
I agree. I had a conversation with a friend who's a writer and who says was arguing that he was a parallel. And I'm like, I think you're taking your total time taking is three times as long as it would have been if you just said instead, I will write this book over this period of time. And that is all I work. Cause it is so much of your bandwidth. Isn't just the hour you're spending writing. It's the 2 hours at lunch thinking about what you've got to write for that. And when you divide that up and it's hard to reset and restart, and again, other people may be different, but I think the more people argue that they're good at multitasking, I think the worse they are at multitasking. People tell me, like, I would look on the outside, I look like a multitasker, but I'm the exact opposite. You know, I'm this thing, this moment, this frame of thought is for here. And then once that's done, maybe I'll pop open something else, whatever, but I don't pop open the other thing when I'm stuck. you know, that's the worst time of the world. And that's when people want to multitask. Like, I'm stuck on this. I'll go work on this. Like, yeah, you'll get an answer to the other thing eventually, but it'll take you much longer than if you just said, how do I solve that?
I think one of the biggest things that I took from being so close to Andrew's work process is the idea of functioning your work existence into getting into that. You know, people like describe it as like in engineering, it's like the code coma, right? Mm-hmm. It's just like this idea where the world kind of dims around you and you're focusing on the project, whatever it might be, right? And then when you kind of come out of it, you realize that a couple hours have passed, right?
Well, we're talking about flow state, right? When you finally hit that groove and the world goes away, you know, I know that when I was editing my own projects, very quickly, entire days could vanish. Just incremental changes, replaying, watching, making those tweaks. And as a result, it's very, very seductive in that format. Whereas something less seductive is looking at a blank page, trying to figure out, I have to fill words in all this. That's very, very hard and taxing and challenging. But once you get over that hump, it becomes so, so pleasing.
So that's what I've been working towards, is figuring out there are some things that's very, very easy for me to get into a flow state. Like programming, super easy to get into a flow state because you've got a list of problems you're trying to solve. And so you're just sequentially going, first, I got to get this thing to work, and then I got to get this. So you know what your problem is because you start off to write a program knowing this is what the outcome is going to be. And I've been applying that, and I've applied back and forth writing books. How does this apply in books? I had an interesting conversation last week with the director talking about, like, you know, my process about, you know, and it was interesting because they really liked my process. He really liked my process for writing, and mine was sort of very the same thing. It's like I establish the bigger thing, the bigger conflict, the bigger problem, like a program or whatever like this. Then I break it down into the smaller conflicts and the many things I have to do there. Now I put a character in this with a personality and a way of making these decisions and choosing these things. And when I follow that pattern of how I write a book, the book goes very, very smoothly. If I just take an outline and say, let me go write this, it's not as clear, and I have to think up those steps. It's like anything. Like if you want to write a piece of code, you've got to break down the problem into the smaller tasks. If I want to write a book, it's not just say this is a chapter. A chapter is a meaningless phrase. It has to mean this is a scene. Segment. It starts with a conflict. Yeah, exactly. Right. Starts and ends.
This is a module. And in fact, I think that's part of the reason that of all the various social media platforms, Twitter has ultimately been my favorite, because it's a series of very small modules that just need to be solved, whether it's to acknowledge somebody's frustration, whether it's to respond with a witty rejoinder, whether it's you know, to have a conversation or whatever. And we're at a weird place, whereas email, because it's so free form, you can get this 3-page thing of somebody telling you their life's thing. It's so amorphous that it's challenging for me to ever get that back out. And you know, I do my best to try to. However, at replies, because there's never an expectation of writing more than 280 characters, always, all day long, happy to do those.
The problem with Facebook is that Facebook is this, it's a starting point. They want that every photo, every comment, a starting point to then keep pulling you back into this dialogue and conversation. So it's not just like, hey, check this out. Oh, cool. How's your mom? Blah, blah, blah. And I kind of like, oh, geez, you know, the obligations now for attention to other people is overwhelming. So it's February now, 2 months Facebook free.
Congratulations. Good on you, man.
Congratulations. No, look, man, oh God, I can't. Then God forbid you friend somebody and now you're connected on Messenger, and now I got to go to Messenger, which is just a
cesspool.
And
I am sure I've missed out on opportunities I'm sure of that. But I'm at a point right now in my life where I'm very comfortable saying I have so many opportunities on my plate. The fact that there is this filter is not a bad thing because I'm at the point where I'm like, I have to weigh everything I go do or every decision, every meeting, because I know, like, you know, chances are 50-50. This thing is going to lead to, yes, we want to do this thing. And then I'm like, well, that's another thing that I now have to figure out how to manage that with everything else. So,
you know. If we can jump in early to picks, I got a pick that has a question attached to it that I think you guys would find interesting. there's a program. First of all, is that cool with you guys? I just sort of announced and then started going.
I'll say aye.
Okay, good.
And also, it doesn't have to be a pick. You could just. Yeah.
Well, it's tied in with my pick. Okay, so spoiler alert as to what my pick is going to be. My pick is going to be a podcast called Under the Influence from the Canadian Broadcast Company, the CBC. And it is very radio, by which I mean highly structured, and you can tell where the ad breaks are, and it follows a very simple formula or a very regular formula that involves, you know, a setup, a sideways thing, a whatever, an XYZ, and then the summary at the end. However, Terry O'Reilly is an industry pro who's been in the trenches, and so the whole thing is about the world of marketing and advertising, and he explains the core principles and tells amazing stories of ad campaigns that worked and didn't work. But recently he had an episode specifically about comic book ads, and it was my favorite episode he's done. I enjoyed it so much that I wrote him an email, and we exchanged pleasantries I expressed what a fan I am of his stuff. Comic books, he talks about the Comic Code Authority and about how, you know, people were worried that comic books were corrupting their youth. And so the Comics Code Authority tightly regulated the content of the comic book, but in no way regulated the content of the ads. And so as a result, you know, he tells the story of the guy who created Sea Monkeys. And for example, this photo that we're seeing right here, Darling Pet Monkey, the squirrel monkey, that was a real thing. For $18.95, they packaged hundreds of thousands of squirrel monkeys and sent them into the United States, this invasive species. And the part that really stuck with me, outside of the nostalgia, you know, if I say the insult that made a man out of Mac, you know exactly the story that I'm talking about. The Charlie Atlas, the skinny kid getting sand kicked in his face, he gets buff and then punches the bully and all that stuff. The part that really stuck with me is someone's assessment, and I'm so sad that I can't remember the names right now. Maybe it's in the article, but he said that because of the nature of comic books and because parents were never going to sit down and read them with the kids, advertisements in comic books were, I'm going to do my best to quote this correctly, a secret conversation between advertisers and children with no parental supervision. Which is why you were able to make these outrageous claims of all these things that none of which lived up to their expectations. The X-ray specs did not give you X-ray powers. Yeah, the wooded lodge was, you know, a piece of mylar with a house painted on it that you would drape over some couch cushions or whatever. But that idea of a secret conversation between advertisers and children with no parental supervision resonated with me, because in many ways, scam stuff is a grown-up adult version of this of exactly this. I'm trying to appeal to adults with the fantasy of being a ninja spy, what robot, whatever. But it made me very aware that children are watching Scam School and The Modern Rogue as well. Although that isn't so bad, because oftentimes they're watching it with parents or they're watching it on video where parents could see the messaging. And I realized that the 21st century version of this secret conversation is in all of these free apps. I will never watch my 5-year-old play her pretty princess dress-up game, but it is deeply disturbing to me when she comes to me and says, "Dad, will you do this? I can't go back to Pretty Princess dress-up game until I murder this zombie." That's an ad for another free app. And and I realize these apps are the 21st century version of this comic book secret conversation.
Well, that in YouTube, the YouTube videos that they've been having the problem with.
The ones that are designed to be hypnotic for children and utterly intolerable for adults.
Yeah, I'm gonna send Bryce.
Spider-Man, Elsa.
Yeah, exactly.
I'm going to send Bryce an image, by the way, just of something kind of amusing.
Okay, well, In the meantime, let me just shower praise on Under the Influence. It's great. If you want to hear stories of conventional advertising and brilliant storytelling and engagement and people thinking outside of the box, coming up with campaigns, and it's highly nostalgic too, because half the time when he's describing the setup, it's a fun game to bet, like, oh my God, I think he's talking about the story of the Energizer Bunny. Oh my God, he is. You know, it's a really great program, and I like it a lot.
I just sent Bryce an image of what I used to use as an ad for my stuff.
this is great. It's straight up the Johnson Smith catalog.
Yep. back when weirdthings.com is where I had my magic site.
Oh, that's great.
Yeah. That was because I had the same epiphany you did. I'm like, yeah, I went to the back of that comic book and I'm like, I loved the potential and the promise. And what was this? And what was going to, you know, what was involved there? You know,
well, plus also is the artifact of the fact that once you read the story, you know, oftentimes, well, now what are you going to do? It's like, well, you could read the story again, or, well, look, there's all these interesting sub stories in the margins over here.
Yeah, I had, you know, my whole plans for, like, you know, becoming like Batman based upon using the, they had the little fold up binoculars, you know, they had, like, you know, the ninja outfit, all this sort of stuff. It was all there. It was all there. There was one of those, man, we talked about this years ago. The guy who was one of the Kung Fu masters or whatever, Master So-and-so, you'd see his ad.
Oh, that's right. It would promise you that you would get ancient Chinese secrets, basically.
Are you teaching the death touch or something like this? Yeah. And yeah, I remember like looking up the story on this guy, and it was just this fascinating kind of, like, you know, morbid kind of, I think, armed robbery, all sorts of stuff.
Here it is. Kung Fu and karate. You learn by looking and listening the easy way for less than 16 cents per lesson.
No, but there was another one. The guy, you would see this. There was a photo of this guy with this big fro. Count Dante, deadliest man alive, Black Dragon Fighting Society.
So one of the things Terry O'Reilly says in his radio program is, you know, on the one hand, oh, that's right, I do remember this one. He sort of questioned, like, on the one hand, is this a case of taking advantage of the baby boomer generation, or is this a case of building up healthy skepticism, or did it make a generation of cynics out of it? Because I think all of us bought some of this stuff at some point. But, man, when he starts quoting the numbers in millions that were made on this, it really puts a stark light on what's happening in the app market right now.
There's also a case that happened really recently, and not to get too much into YouTube drama sort of stuff, but one of those Paul brothers has his Team 10 thing, and he was selling this educational video series, and it's, you know, Team 10,000 or Team 1,000 or something.
Right.
And so you pay $7 to kind of get in the door, and you see a few clips. But the insidious part about it is that you would, you know, sign up with the credit card to pay the $7. But then once you dug like another inch deeper, there's a whole library of videos that'll teach you everything about how to make it on YouTube.
Sure.
And that's only $57. All you have to do is click this button, and kids, you already got your parents' credit card information in the site, and they don't have to re-enter it, to the point where banks were seeing those transactions and calling them scam, like,
wow,
flagging them as fraud.
It was
that sort of insidious thing of, like, you get in the door, and then once you're there, you just wiggle your way out.
Marketing to kids, man, that's a weird thing, because
for my generation, it was 1-900 numbers.
Yeah.
1-900-976. That grew up, that, like, exploded in the 80s for everything. Everything had a 900 number. And I remember looking up the numbers once, because I named the wrestling podcast that I'll be doing in about an hour is 1-900 Wrestling, because it became so gigantic. The WWF one, or the Hulk Hogan 1-900 number, was like one of the most popular of all time. But similarly, like the amount that they made on those things. And all you did was on kids programming that appealed to a lot of children, just put up this number, talk to your hero right now, please get your parents' permission.
Or American Idol. You would call in to vote, and there was no limit. You just kept calling in to vote for your person.
Yeah.
And those were all, I'm sure those were all some sort of charge.
Did they charge to vote? Or I
don't think the American Idol ones were
But that was at a time where I think you could text, and texting was not always free.
Got it.
Yeah, texting, there might have been limited stuff on texting.
Yeah, yeah. It's crazy.
Someone in the chat room says, I remember getting in trouble calling the 1-900 number from the Howard the Duck movie ad.
Wow.
Everybody of a certain age knew a kid that, like, got their ass kicked because they spent too long trying to figure out something on a 1-900 number.
I think this was before I got my own cell phone, but on like the family cell phone or something, they had, it was one of the classic clamshell flip phones, whatever. One day they, you know, it had rudimentary internet access, and it had some like dungeon crawling RPG game.
Yeah.
That I only spent a few minutes just like, okay, you can click through it. And
this was text-based?
It was like a browser-based.
Okay.
It was like rudimentary browser-based. And I remember one day just like, hey, the bill is really expensive this month. What's this data? Like, But it's any way they can get you, they'll try to get you.
Well,
yeah, you look for an efficiency or an exploit in the system, and then you try to, you know, take advantage of that. And as kids have access to parents' credit card numbers and able to, you know, have disposable income, it's going to happen. It's going to happen. And then, you know, you look at, you know, scams and stuff that prey upon adults. That might be something entirely different episode we can talk about, like, you know, the danger of a lot of these get rich things or whatever.
You know,
like,
what?
That
I actually would like to dive into that. That'd be a fun thing for next week, is talking about the hedonistic treadmill of the success industry and the ups and downs of it.
Man, I have a buddy that's a pretty good businessman, pretty good entertainer, who will tell me about, you know, I went to this seminar, got this, I get this course, it was great. I signed up for so-and-so's course, you know, it was $5,000, but it's great. It's got a lot of, I'm like, how much are you spending on these things? He's like, oh, I'm getting a lot of value out of it. I'm like, I'm sure you're getting good stuff, but man, this sounds like an industry to prey upon people who are into this industry kind of thing. And like professional, like, man, speakers. And
knowing the person that you're talking about, if that money had been spent on continuing to reinvest in his own business, which is does well, I think he would have a substantively different.
Is it me? It's me. It's me you're talking about, isn't it? It's me.
Well, I mean, you know, a thing I thought about was, I toil with the idea of like, oh, do I want to do more lecturing? You know, do I want to go do more talks? Do I want to go do more of that? And I thought, like, I wouldn't mind doing more of that, but do I want that to be my primary thing that I'm doing? Because if that's my primary thing that I'm doing, then I'm not really doing the things that I want to do. You know, and some of these business mentors and stuff like this, like, man, if these guys are great captains of industry, then I would think they would be captaining big industries instead of showing up at a Holiday Inn trying to sell you a $3,000 course. You know, not to say that there's aren't values to some of those things. And sometimes it's like, you know, sometimes you hear narrow course, like, hi, how to improve your plumbing business or something like that, which is probably not a bad idea or something like that. And I think a lot of people could benefit from some of the knowledge out there, but it does become this sort of,
I'll tell you what, I'm curious. Next week we'll talk about it, because I think Brian will probably have the most to say about it, because I've heard you talk about these kinds of things a lot. But man, for everyone like that's there to help, boy, does it seem like there are 10 that are literally there to just get you into a hotel ballroom and sign up for the next hotel ballroom.
Yeah. Which reminds me, we're going to do a plug here for the new After Things Academy, which if you're
looking for excellence. If you really, really, really want to get the real deal, there's another hotel ballroom that we'd love to get
you. Save it all for next week. We're out of time.
Picks?
Mine is Under the Influence by Terry O'Reilly. It's a CBC program. Very bingeable. You can go back. There's like probably hundreds of episodes, each one expertly storytelling. And it's all about the thinking behind the ads that changed the face of Western civilization.
A lot of people ask, we got the new pins going up at the end of the week. The Anyway, See You Later pins. I've been getting these done at allaboutpins.com. great. One of these businesses that are really, really smart, man. They're a little company out of, I think, like Winter Park, Florida, outside of Orlando. But literally their job is to just be the middlemen between you and China. So China prices with English customer service. Boy, howdy, does their cut is their cut worth it when you actually get what you want from a Chinese factory at that kind of price? So go ahead and check them out. Allaboutpins.com.
Groovy. The book I'm in the process of listening to is, I think it's just Alibaba. And I think it's the story of Jack Ma and creation of Alibaba. Cause it's one of these things where, you know, I'm very guilty of often having a, you know, an American bias towards things. You know, the internet is like, yeah, it's, you know, what goes on here. And meanwhile, turns out rest of the world bigger than America. Fun fact, didn't realize that. And you look at, let's say you take Alibaba, which is kind of their version of, you know, Amazon and Walmart and whatever, you know, there are more Alibaba customers in China than there are Amazon customers in America, you know, and this is an entirely, you know, other story about somebody. And sometimes it's kind of like, it's interesting to see how these things turned out there. And funny too is that they talk about some of these other Chinese internet pioneers. One of them is a guy that Randy, who I worked for, used to know. Randy years ago went with PsyCop to this mission to China, you know, in the 1980s, and they had a translator that they made friends with and stayed in touch with. And this guy went on to become like an internet gazillionaire. I don't know. So Randy bought him his first bicycle when he came to the United States to study. And it's just, you know, funny where you're like, oh wow, it's like, twice I've listened to biographies. I'm like, oh, I've met this person or I know this person. So it's cool. So Bryce.
Oh, yeah, I got a pick. I kept up with some of the promotional material for it because it kind of falls under the Cord Killers element. And I didn't love much of any of it. They put out a teaser and the teaser didn't say anything. And then they put out a trailer and the trailer was kind of all over the place. But I spent about an hour last night watching Everything Sucks, the new Netflix original,
mm-hmm.
and it's nice and charming. You know, it takes place in the 90s, and so there's a lot of over like, oh man, but
is there Atlantis any Morris affiliation with Everything Is Terrible or
no.
Okay, okay.
No. It's like a high school.
Oh, that's right. Yeah, we watched the preview for this.
Yeah. So you get these hokey 90s moments of like, oh, Alanis Morissette's not being ironic, man, and Wonderwall. But there's a surprisingly complicated love story that is going on in there between these high schoolers. And I didn't think I would like it as much as I did. So if that sounds like something that you might be into, a kind of 90s high school romance sort of series, check it out. Everything Sucks.
I have a problem with this nostalgic stuff set during time periods where I'm sure I still have clothes I've not thrown out yet from that time period.
Hoo boy.
That I'm not holding on to ironically.
They do this weird thing at the very beginning where it's kind of like establishing shots and whatever. And it doesn't set the best tone for the show because the high school that they go to is called Boring High School. And it makes you because all this these trailers and stuff were so bad, I thought, oh, is this going to be like an over the top, like on its you know, sleeves, like weird parody satire thing? And no, it's just the high school is called Boring High School and it's not goofy in that way.
Yeah. I have not watched it because I refuse to admit that that now
the 90s were a long time ago.
Safe nostalgia is like literally my childhood because I was around the age that the characters are supposed to be in the show. And it's like, I know at some point someone's going to play Alice in Chains to sell me a boner pill, but I'm just not ready to go there yet.
I'm just like, I have adult clothes from that period. I have adult clothes. I could be an adult in that period and I'm not cool with this. I'm not comfortable with it. Like, I threw out, like, I was cleaning out my house in Florida, and, like, maybe a year ago or whatever, I threw away a suit that, like, I graduated high school in. Because you just have a suit. Like, I hardly wear a suit. I'll just put this in the closet. You go through, like, suit. Then one day I took the suit out. I'm like, this is ridiculous. I'm not, I was keeping it not because, oh, one day this will be neat. I'm like, oh, I just need to keep an extra suit. I'm like, I can't. This suit is like so out of fashion. Yeah, and
you would be wearing a costume if you walked out in public with that.
Yeah, I'm like, oh, man, I'm old. I'm old.
Well, you can relive the good old days with Everything Sucks. It's on Netflix.
Yeah, I'm going to go put on my Z Cavaricci's. All right, guys. It's been after.
Diamond Club hopes you have enjoyed this program.